Welcome to the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast for hormonal mamas who want to reclaim their own natural state of health to thrive and raise healthy kids. I'm Dr. Lisa Weeks, naturopathic doctor in Toronto, Canada. I'm a perimenopausal mama to my toddler named Stuart.
And I'm Dr. Toni Reed. I'm a naturopathic doctor, birth doula, and hypnobirthing educator in Calgary, Alberta. And I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little girl, Frankie. The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not meant to substitute professional medical advice. Always consult with your licensed healthcare provider. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast. This is Dr. Toni, and today I'm really glad to have someone to talk to about a really important topic. You know, we're at the end of November in 2020. We've been dealing with almost 8 months of this pandemic. And it's really had an impact on a lot of our lives in a number of different ways. And one of the ways that it may be impacting your life or the life of your loved one is in dealing with, you know, the things that we go to in terms of dealing with stress. And it may also have a big piece in making substance use and substance use disorders, addictions, more difficult to deal with. So I really wanted to talk to an expert about this. And so I'm very happy to have Kristen Moore with us today. She's a Calgary-based certified professional recovery coach, intervention specialist. She works a lot with professionals, executives, business owners, families, in terms of dealing with and addressing substance dependency issues to really, again, help not only the individual, but the people around them to, you know, work to a place where, again, people can seek help, get the resources that they need, and be able to make the best choices for themselves. Thanks so much for joining me today, Kristen.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dr. Toni. I'm thrilled to be here.
I think it's just so important for us to talk about this topic, especially, I mean, I know here in Calgary, I've seen news reports of, recovery centers having, a real spike in the wait lists. So we know that there's stats around people struggling right now with substance use and mental health issues, and even more than before. We already had a problem before pandemic, and now just thinking about how a lot of people can be struggling even more. How have you found, how your work has changed with pandemic, but also maybe we can even start with the idea of the languaging that we use around mm-hmm. substance use and addiction. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's really important to sort of dispel some of the myths around the disorder of dealing with substance use. In the past, addiction can be a very stigmatizing term, and it doesn't really encompass the actual medical definitions of what a substance use disorder is. And so I think moving away from old language and into newer language that is embraced by the medical community, and they see it as the disorder that it is, the mental health issue that it is really important. So language plays a big key in it, and it's a getting away from the shaming and blaming that the old language uses.
For sure. I think that's so key. So let's get in terms of that, those kind of misconceptions traditionally that have really carried over into right now. Because I've even, seen on social media certain people making comments that really, really reflect the same kind of thinking around substance use and addictions that has been, you know, for years and years. You know, what do you say to people who think that behaviors around substance dependency are just about like a choice and poor choices on a you know, on an individual?
Yeah, that's just such an old thought. And I think it's important to understand the definition of what substance use disorder is. So understanding what the medical community defines it as, and they define it as a primary chronic disease of brain reward. It's around motivation and memory and related circuitry. So the fact that it, you know, they're defining it right off the bat, this is primarily a chronic disease of the brain. So that tells me probably not much of a choice is going into that. And just the characteristics of it, you know, according to DSM-5, it's biological, it's social. There's psychology and broader spiritual inputs that are related to it. It's characterized by continuously pursuing reward and or relief by a substance or other behaviors, quite honestly. It isn't limited to just substances. You can have issues around shopping. You can have issues around gaming or video games, that sort of stuff. And it's prone to cycles of relapse and remission. And there's definitely morbidity and potentially mortality involved. So like, this isn't a choice. This isn't a moral failing on somebody's part. Like, this is literally brains are wired differently, and it's manifesting itself in these different ways. So for somebody that's still stuck on that idea that it's a moral failing, I would just say, you know, maybe do some research around what the Medical Council of Canada says, or the Canadian Mental Health Association mm-hmm. says, mm-hmm. or the American Medical Association, or the World Health Organization. So it really is, it's a disorder, and it's recognized as that because the science has caught up has actually been known for a long time that it is, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they really see it as twofold. It's a almost an allergy and a physical reaction. So there's two parts that happen. There's sort of that mental obsession and then the physical reaction. And so it's twofold. And the science is now caught up with what those thoughts were back in the day. So it is shown. So that's what I would say to people.
For sure.
Research.
Yeah. And especially that idea of, okay, you know, it being brain-based, and even that idea of, you know, that kind of oversensitivity, you know, in that idea of an allergy, because, you know, there may be some people who think, well, you know, I went through tough things in my life, and you know, I don't have any issues with substance use or addiction to any kind of behaviors. I'm fine. But again, it really is looking at our individual makeup and how some people are just again potentially more susceptible to addictive behaviors and substance use. You know, everyone's a little bit different in terms of their individual biochemistry and their individual health, not only that physically and our kind of our wiring, but also what has been happening in our lives and kind of our social structures and the support systems that we have.
Mm-hmm. The way that I like to look at it is, if you look at substance use disorder sort of being a three-legged stool, and often you need all three legs for that stool. So there's definitely science behind there being a genetic link to it. You know, so you see it run in families, there's a hereditary link to it. It can also be trauma based and environmental. You know, if you grow up in an environment where, and I think a lot of us have in Canada, where consumption of alcohol is very normalized, celebrated in some cases, right? And we're literally putting a poison into our bodies, and that has an impact.
Absolutely. And I mean, that really gets to even something that we were even kind of mentioning before we started recording this too. You know, there is that idea of kind of a celebration in our society and culture of overindulgence. with different substances, especially in terms of alcohol. I think that's probably, you know, the top. So there is this question of like, how do you actually know whether you or a loved one has a substance use disorder versus, you know, an overindulgence to cope with stress, or even kind of just going along with kind of these different cultural pieces or, you know, almost like peer pressure. I mean, I always think about, you know, there's certain aspects of a mommy culture out there and different memes where, you know, it's it kind of celebrates and really normalizes the idea of like a big old glass of wine, you know, being part of the day-to-day experience of a mom, which isn't necessarily, I think, the most healthy kind of behavior. So I don't know, you know, what are your thoughts? And even, you know, are there kind of some hard data or definite data around the idea of where do you draw the line between substance use disorder, addiction, and maybe not necessarily healthy behavior, but behavior that doesn't fall in that category.
Yeah. I'll start with the data because I think we'll do data first and then just what your gut feelings are too, because I think it's important to listen to both. So DSM-5, so I relate or, you know, reference that quite a bit. And that's just the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So the American Psychiatric Association, 10 years, they do a huge release and pull together the research and opinions of literally hundreds of international experts to come up with this DSM-5 model. So they define and classify mental disorders in order to improve diagnosis for physicians and treatment options, and as well as the research money that goes into it. And they really looked at what does substance use disorder look like? And they really came up, there's sort of 11 sort of key indicators. And if you don't mind, I'll read them out because
for sure.
I think when you hear them, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I've had that happen or I've been there. So the first one is hazardous use. So you've used the substance in a way that's dangerous to yourself and or others. So that could be things like you've driven while under the influence or you've experienced a blackout while you're drinking. That's what would define that. The next one is social or interpersonal problems related to use. So the substance has caused some sort of relationship problem or conflicts with other people around you. So maybe somebody has said something to you about your drinking. Okay. Another one would be you've neglected major roles and because of your use. So you failed to meet responsibilities maybe at work or at school or at home because of your substance use. Withdrawal. When you stop using the substance, you experience withdrawal symptoms. So it could be things like shaky hands in the morning, that sort of stuff, depending on what you're using. Tolerance. So you have built up a tolerance to the substance, so you have to use more to get the same effect. Okay. You use larger amounts for longer. So you have to start using larger amounts or use the substance for longer amounts of time again, just to get that same effect that you had initially. Because remember, this is a progressive disease, okay? It's a progressive disorder. You spend a lot of time using your substance. So there's an old adage, thinking about drinking. So you're either thinking about it, you're thinking about doing it, or you're doing it. You start having physical or psychological problems related to your use. So your substance use could have led to physical health problems, such as liver damage or lung cancer or psychological issues, such as depression or anxiety. And it's interesting because stuff that sometimes shows up in the doctor's office can be attributed to some of the stuff, but if that correlation isn't known, you're giving up activities. So you can use. So you've either started skipping activities or you stopped doing activities you once enjoyed because of using the substance. And the final one is craving or a mental obsession. So you're thinking about using that substance. So those are the 11 indicators. Now there is a continuum. So there's sort of a mild, medium, and severe. And so in order to be diagnosed with a substance use disorder, you must meet two or more of those criteria that I just mentioned in a 12-month period. So if you meet two or three of the criteria, you have a mild substance use disorder. 4 to 5 is considered moderate. And if you meet 6 or more, you have a severe substance use disorder.
Which is interesting. Again, there's that continuum because, I mean, some people, especially if there's someone who isn't directly impacted by substance use dependency, that will think of, an addict kind of at the end of that kind of progression.
Yeah, like I'm not drinking daily. I don't get up in the morning and drink. I'm not living under a bridge by the drop-in center. You know, so the denial that we can keep ourselves in can keep us sort of continuing down that path because we're not recognizing the signs early enough. And I think it's important to recognize those and know about those because there's the old belief that you have to hit a pretty big rock bottom to want to get the help. And so my question is, why do we have to wait until we blow up our lives? Why can't we actually maybe start reaching out for help a little earlier so that we're not suffering all these consequences? And I think a lot of people that struggle with alcohol use, I think deep down, there's kind of that feeling, it's like, oh, am I drinking normally? And often people may surround with themselves with people that drink the same way that they do. Mm. So again, that normalizes your behavior. And you know, when you look at what the guidelines are for alcohol use, and we're talking about alcohol because it's still the number one substance that's being used by far. I totally lost my train of thought there. But that's okay.
In terms of, I think you were leading towards the normal level of alcohol use.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I'm glad one of us is paying attention.
Which I think it is important to kind of to talk about alcohol as well. Especially, I mean, we are in the middle of a big issue with opioid use. But again, a lot of that can be, or often is illegal, whether it is, someone using more kind of, for the lack of a better term, street drugs or getting prescriptions in, in a non-legal way. But again, when we're looking at behavior that it can be normal in culture, in our culture, in our society, alcohol is kind of at the top of the list.
Yeah, and it's interesting because opioids get a ton of press, and because the death is happening quickly, the amount of death attributed to alcohol consumption is also huge. It's just being labeled something else. It's either, heart failure, high blood pressure, all of these different things. And when you look at the substance abuse cost to Canada, so this is an older number, 2014, but the substance use cost was $38 billion. Of that $38 billion, opioids was only $2.5 billion. Alcohol was $16.7 billion.
Mm-hmm. That's a huge amount.
It's a much higher number. And recent numbers show that they were looking at the percentage of the population. So right now, 3.2% of the population is abusing alcohol or is addicted to it. And that's more than 1 million Canadians. And 70% of people that are abusing or addicted to alcohol actually work full or part time, so it's all around us. And so the Canadian guidelines right now, and there was actually just a really interesting article in the Globe and Mail, I believe about 2 months ago, that was kind of calling out our drinking guidelines as being too high, like still causing problems. So right now, the Canadian drinking guidelines is 10 drinks a week for women.
That's a lot of alcohol.
It is. And they're seeing that even if you're following those guidelines, there was another study that just came out of UBC around cancer and the correlation between alcohol use and cancer, especially in women and breast cancer, that 50% of those cases are people that are following the guidelines for alcohol use. So it has an impact. And, you know, the guidelines are no more than 3 drinks for women on a single occasion. But when you start to look at, well, what is a standard drink? A standard pour in a restaurant is 2 drinks for a glass of wine. Mm-hmm. 1 glass of wine equals 2 drinks under the Canadian guidelines. That's a 9-ounce pour. So 1 bottle of wine is 5 drinks.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to really kind of phrase it in a way where people make sense, especially, I mean, you know, you're talking about restaurant pours, but, you know, a lot of people now are drinking at home because we're not going to a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I know when I've poured myself a glass of wine at home, sometimes I have a heavy hand in pouring. So it really is, I think it's really important to have a sense of like, okay, at home, are you just having a glass of wine? Is that like one drink or are you having multiple drinks in one glass?
Yeah. Portion control.
Yes, absolutely.
Because some of those wine glasses, especially if you're looking at red wine glasses, they're quite large.
They're huge. And we're not just talking about the novelty sized ones either, but the actual regular sized ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly. So I think being able to have some education around that and just framing and then, you know, women can make an informed decision. Maybe I am drinking a bit too much. And, mm-hmm. and you know, the good litmus test is just try to stop drinking for a while. See how that goes. Like mm-hmm. stop for a couple of weeks, see how you feel. And if you're experiencing some issues around stopping drinking, like finding that I'm actually having trouble stopping, then, you know, there's an opportunity to maybe look a little bit deeper into that and have a discussion with some people that you trust in your circle, either friends or your doctor.
Which is, you know, leads me to really kind of think, okay, what are the options, you know, in terms of really kind of starting to get a handle on, you know, different behaviors, whether it's substance use or otherwise, you know, what are the treatment options right now? And especially for someone who may not feel comfortable talking with family or friends because again of that stigma and shame that's around it, or who doesn't have a doctor they necessarily trust to give them the information or different resources.
Yeah, I think it's important to kind of recognize where you are on the curve, and mm-hmm. so there's different tools available depending on where you are in that substance use curve. And there really is a curve because, you know, everybody starts off, you know, the pleasure of having a glass of wine. And then all of a sudden it shifts from being pleasure to coping. And all of a sudden you're using that substance in a different way. And that's the area that I think there's the opportunity to really kind of be able to catch it at that point if we can increase the dialogue around it and increase the knowledge around what a substance use disorder looks like. So, you know, if you're just entering into that curve, you know, maybe it is doing some online stuff. Like there's some really great support groups for women. There is She Recovers, which you can do meetings with them. It's all online. There's tools and resources available. There's sober mom groups. I think if you just even go in and just type in some stuff, you know, that there's a great one called Thinking About Drinking. And, you know, it's a woman sharing her own experience of coming to that realization where there's something wrong here. I don't know what it is, but I'm not that person that I think an alcoholic looks like. So anyway, so she has helped a lot of people sort of recognize, yeah, this isn't working out for me, and starts, you know, bringing different tools in. I'm a recovery coach. And so that's one of the things I love doing is working with people that have a willingness to kind of explore, okay, this tool, this maladaptive coping tool that I've been using, like alcohol, isn't working for me anymore. What can we do to create a new foundation and create, you know, a more sober approach to life? But what are the tools that we can start working on and create some goals around that? And so there's people like recovery coaches. Getting curious and doing reading. There's a fantastic book by Ann Dowsett Johnson called Drink, and the intimate relationship between women and alcohol. And that was an eye-opener reading that one. I would recommend it to anybody that's kind of like curious about, you know, what a substance use disorder looks like, because she goes not only through her own experience as an incredibly high-functioning woman involved in the academic world, but also looks at just the socialization of women. So we're talking about, you know, the mummy memes on the internet, and just really we're seeing a repeat of what the smoking industry did to market to women happening again now with alcohol, right? And, you know, she looks at just the socialization of young women and going to university and the drinking cultures and the drinking culture in Canada. It's a great read. So for those that are just kind of entering into it, it's an opportunity to get curious and start doing some reading and start looking at different options. You know, there's peer support groups, which are fantastic, and they're free. And, you know, there's lots of different options available on what your substance of choice is, but it starts creating a community around people that have gone through the same thing. And again, making sobriety a little bit more normalized. So some options at that beginning of the curve, when you're kind of falling down and getting into more of that crucial zone where you're starting to get some consequences. And, you know, in the DSM-5 categories, you're sort of getting to that 4, 5, 6 area. You may need to get some medical intervention. There may need to be a detox. There may need to be treatment. But there's lots of different ways to approach it. And I think working with somebody that can help tailor to the individual is really, really important and create more of a holistic approach to it, because it isn't just one size fits all. You know, to be able to have a continuum of care, it really requires having, you know, an expert or a professional that can help, you know, look at some of the stuff in the past that maybe the drinking is being done over. You know, working with, you know, a physician. There's lots of different opportunity around that. And, you know, treatments right now in our society, I think there's a huge gap between treatment and just sort of realizing you have an issue. There isn't sort of a middle ground. It's either kind of treatment or nothing. Treatment, I think, is a great place to do discovery. There is such a great opportunity in being able to focus on yourself for a period of time and really start diving into a lot of different things around that substance use disorder and start to get new tools and start to do a lot of self-discovery. And, you know, the real challenge is once you leave treatment, you need to then start building your recovery, right? Recovery doesn't happen in treatment. You don't go to treatment and come out and it's like, I'm cured. That's when the real work starts up. And so that's also where, you know, working with a recovery coach can come into play to help maintain that sobriety that was achieved under treatment. And then, you know, treatment facilities also have their own aftercare programs, and there's tons of tools, but there has to be a willingness on the individual to want to create that foundation for themselves.
And that's an important key piece too. And I'm so glad you shared all those resources. We'll definitely, you know, put some links on our show notes. But that idea of the willingness, I mean, it's one thing, if, you know, someone who is really kind of looking at these issues for themselves. But then, you know, what do we do when it's not us and it's someone in our life? I'm probably really lucky in the fact that I haven't been directly impacted by someone in my life that I know of that has any kind of substance use disorder. But I definitely know of people who have been dealing with people in their families, in their close circles, with those issues. And then that idea of like, okay, you know, how can you support someone who is dealing with issues around addiction and substance use dependency?
Mm-hmm. It's I love the adage that addiction is not a spectator sport, and everybody gets to get involved in it. The whole family is impacted by it, and quite often the person that has the substance use disorder is lucky because at least they have a tool to be able to deal with everything. The family usually doesn't. And so I've been on that side too, and it's super challenging because it can feel really isolating. You don't know what you don't know, right? Mm-hmm. And anytime you're dealing with a substance use disorder, it is cunning and it's baffling and it's pretty powerful. And you have to be careful not to love the person to death. And so the things that pop up with family is, I think, first of all, communication is so important. A lot of times nothing is said because you don't want to anger the person, or you don't want to, you know, disrupt what's going on. And I, you know, communication is huge, and it's really having a discussion around what you're seeing, because with substance use disorders, there is a ton of denial for the individual that's in it. And one of them is, well, nobody said anything, so how bad can it be? So really having that discussion and just keeping to the facts and trying to keep emotion out of it. So when I'm working with families, it's, you know, this is what I'm seeing. You know, this is like, you drove drunk, just the facts. This happened, you've missed work, you've, you know, whatever is going on, this is what I'm concerned about. You know, this is what I'm fearful of. I am scared that, you know, it's I statements, right? Not you, but I statements. I'm scared that, or I'm concerned that you're going to lose your job or your marriage is going to end, or, you know, whatever that may be. And this is what I hope. And then it's outlining, you know, what some of the tools are, or I would really like you to talk to your family doctor, or I'd like you to, whatever that is. But it gets that cycle of denial, there becomes a crack in that. And so being able to have a conversation is huge, but then you can't change that individual, right?
So, which is so frustrating and heartbreaking oftentimes.
Yeah. And, you know, Al-Anon is a super great resource for family members. And it's really learning, like, you didn't cause this, you can't control it, and you can't change it. It's up to the individual. But what you can control is how you're reacting or acting in this situation. And so it's so important for family members to start getting their own tools in place, you know, to be able to understand about codependency and understand what enabling looks like and how to create healthy boundaries that allow you to love your loved one that's struggling with a substance use disorder as much as you need to love yourself, right? So that distance, that's going to be, so you're not carrying resentments around the individual. So there's lots of great tools. Again, the whole family system has to be in recovery, right? It isn't just the individual, because, you know, if somebody goes off to treatment, that environment is still the same, right? Mm-hmm. If nothing changes. And so there needs to be change at that level too. So I mentioned Al-Anon as being a great resource for family members. There's also CODA, which is Codependence Anonymous. Fantastic resource for family members. One of the things that I do a lot of interventions. So I'm working with families quite often to try and get their loved one to choose to go to treatment. And COVID has been one benefit in the sense that the Hazelton Betty Ford Center has a fantastic family program around addiction that I often recommend to families to go and participate in, even if their loved one isn't going to treatment or is going to a treatment, different treatment facility. And it's typically a 3-day program. And during COVID, they realized that families really need support. And so what they've done is they have put that all online and it's free. So you can sign up for a full day session and go through with other family members that are dealing with the same thing. They have one specifically as well for children. So there's lots of tools available. And I think that's where it's important to be able to reach out and talk to somebody that maybe knows the different paths that can be taken and just make sure that there aren't any barriers to recovery, either on the family's end or the individual's end. So sort of knocking down those barriers.
That's fantastic that, again, there's can be those silver linings of COVID and to have such a renowned program be available to a lot of people that it wouldn't be available to otherwise is really amazing. And it's, again, it's interesting when we first talked and even, again, knowing that you do work, with interventions with families, that kind of thing. Cause again, probably my first, introduction to the idea of an intervention was from like the TV show, on A&E Intervention, which I think is even, I think they put a season of that on Netflix. So, you know, again, that idea of really looking outside of the family to, for someone to support those kind of conversations and that kind of work with someone, is there, what do people need to know about interventions, or what do people get wrong about interventions? Do you find?
I think, that show, yeah, intervention should not be a National Spectator sport. Oh. That was cringy. I think there are so many different types of interventions, and what you see on intervention are surprise interventions. So, and those can be pretty, it puts the individual into pretty defensive roles. So, the methodology that I really like, and again, sometimes you have to do a surprise because you've got somebody that's just so unwilling to participate in their own health and recovery. But, I really like an invitational intervention. So it's really inviting the family member to a family meeting, essentially, and really being able to have just an honest dialogue around it, basically what I just went through. Like, this is what we're seeing, you know, this is what we're concerned about, and this is what we hope. And to have something set up. So that is one thing that is true to the show, is a really good intervention is one where when the individual decides they're done and they just don't want to try and fight it anymore, that they can get the help that they need immediately, like getting into a treatment facility. That's one thing that's somewhat difficult to do within the public healthcare system, because like you had mentioned, the wait list, like Aventa right now has a 3-month waiting list. Mm. And so you can't necessarily do an intervention and then wait 3 months. That's when you'd want to do some sort of combination of doing some recovery coaching until that person can get into treatment. But I think the interventionist is there to support the family and to empower the family and educate the family and really be there as a resource. What you don't see is the interventionist actually works with the family for at least a month after the intervention to support the family members as well.
And that's important to know for sure, to know that, again, people aren't on their own. And again, that isn't just the end of the work, but like you said, it's almost like the beginning of the work.
Yeah, very much, very much. And that, you know, you're not alone. And I think that's, as I mentioned earlier, like the whole disorder around substance misuse is one of isolation, and the family gets that isolation as well, because again, the fear and the stigma, and it just, everybody sort of closes in. And so just having somebody to be able to support you through that process and give you the tools that you need to be able to find your voice again is really important.
And that's why I think it's just so important for women and their families to know that again, these resources are available, and that again, people like you exist to really support people through this process, because it can be incredibly challenging and difficult and emotional to go through.
Yeah, it is, each one's different, but they're pretty similar too, and this substance use disorder is one of the most treatable things out there, right? So, even people that may appear to be a lost cause definitely aren't. And it's pretty amazing to see some people kind of climb out of some pretty tough places to lead really happy, wonderful lives. That's the biggest thing recovery brings to the table, is just a whole different way to live. That's much better than it was before.
Mm-hmm. And that's, again, so great to hear. And that must really kind of drive you to do the work you do as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get to see miracles happen on a fairly regular basis, which is good.
That's awesome. And that's so needed. So now if someone's, again, out there listening to this, they're kind of dealing with substance dependency themselves, or they have someone in their life who is dealing with it, and they would like to, get more resources and even touch base with you to see about, again, the support that you can give, because you are doing virtual remote work as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. COVID. Everybody's on a Zoom call these days.
Right. So how can people get in touch with you, Kristen?
They can get in touch with me through my website. So you can go to www.shiftrecovery.ca. And I do free consultations, half an hour consultations. So if you just want to talk and see what's available and just have an ear, you have one on the other end of that 1-888 number. So please reach out. You can email me too through the website. And I've got some blogs that I've posted, and there'll be more of those coming as well. That's the best way to get to me, is through my website, shiftrecovery.ca.
Perfect. We'll put a link to your website on the show notes so that people can, again, access that really easily. And thank you so much for sharing all of the other resources that you mentioned today too, Kristen. Your work, especially now, is, I think, just so important. And again, we need to have more of these conversations to really, kind of look at ending stigma, fear, and the misconceptions around addiction behavior, substance use disorder, and dependency. Thanks so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this, Dr. Tony.
And now we're going to switch gears, and I'm going to talk about my super mom moment for the week. And I hope you guys aren't sick of hearing me talk about my successful potty training with Frankie, but it's been going so well, and I'd like to take credit for it, but I really do think it's probably mostly her and not necessarily anything I'm doing. But again, I'm just going to, make sure that I do get a little bit of credit too, and call it a super mom moment. Being able to not have to rely on diapers and pull-ups and that kind of thing is so great. Now, she's still not night trained yet. So, but day training has definitely been a big shift and change. I'm pretty proud of myself and pretty proud of her for going through that pretty easily. Not to say that it's always perfect, but speaking of not perfect, that's where my mama mess up for this week. Was a little incident with a zipper. I was zipping up her pajamas the other night, and I don't know how it happened, but I caught the zipper on the skin of her little belly, and just broke my heart. There was definitely tears on for both of us, and definitely a huge mama mess up. I felt terrible, and have definitely learned my lesson in terms of really paying attention to what I'm doing with zippers. Now, today's mama must have, given again the conversation that I've had with Kristen today, I think it's really important to kind of look at, you know, healthy coping mechanisms and even just ways to escape in a somewhat healthy way. And that's where my mama must have right now is probably something that a lot of you out there have already taken or participated in. And that's getting into the Netflix show, The Crown. You know, I had tried to watch it months and months ago, and I just didn't quite get into it. Now I'm watching it with my partner, Davin. And again, it's just been really interesting to see that kind of historical drama. And again, just going to a different time and a different place is kind of fun and getting away from thinking about, you know, what's going on in the real world. So that's my mama must have today. So thanks so much, everyone, for joining us today. Again, thanks to Kristen Moore for all of that information on dealing with substance dependency. Please, again, connect with us on our website. That's where all of our show notes are, all of those links for all of that information at perimenopausalmamas.com. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Instagram. If you enjoy this episode, we'd love for you to leave us a review, 5-star rating, and we'd love for you to subscribe. And all of those ways gives us the ability to share more with other perimenopausal mamas out there as well. Stay safe and healthy, everyone. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.